Hey, what's up, you guys? It's been a while since I've done Here's the Pitch with Mike Techno. So in this episode of the podcast, I am going to be talking about the 2016 Ghostbusters remake, reboot, whatever you want to call it, directed by Paul Feig. I want to start it off by saying this movie was doomed from the very, very start. That is the reason why it technically was a flop, even though it did make a little bit of a profit. It's why, you know, it's doomed from the start because you bring back a franchise that is so incredibly well known and loved, and then you do a girl version. I don't know why this is the way it is, but sadly, this is the case. And it failed commercially because so many people spoke out against it. And part of that, I really, really do have to contribute to the marketing of the film. I think that it didn't do this film justice. Now, it's unfortunate because if it was marketed differently and, you know, because so many people saw it as, oh yeah, this is the new Ghostbusters franchise. We're not getting any more of the classic stuff. No more continuation of the classic stuff. When that simply wasn't the case. This was just a project that was, you know, brought to Sony, created by Sony, one of the two, and then that pushed Sony to actually create an entire division of their company dedicated to Ghostbusters projects, like the latest Ghostbusters remastered edition of the video game that came out in 2007, 2006, I believe. And then also there is a animated version of Ghostbusters in the works. There is Ghostbusters 2020 that is supposed to be coming out next year. There is, you know, this was just the starting point for Sony to finally push all these new Ghostbusters projects. Now, it was marketed in a really unfortunate way. It was marketed as the new Ghostbusters, a complete remake, not going back to the old franchise when, frankly, that was never the case. And that's why so many people hated on it. So many people thought that this was just the wrong movie to make for this series, which I think is kind of wrong. This is a movie that, even when I saw it in theaters, being a diehard Ghostbusters fan, it's not a bad movie because Ghostbusters was never originally made to be a groundbreaking, you know, it wasn't made for a groundbreaking blockbuster hit that is, you know, the peak of cinema in 1984 when it came out. It was not that. It was much like this movie, made as just a fun popcorn flick type of film that then just gained cult status and was a huge hit. Now, I love the original. I love Ghostbusters 2. And I love the TV show, which is its own amazing thing that doesn't get enough recognition. But this film, it really isn't as bad as people brought it up to be. It's writing was solid. The terminology they used, yes, could have been more refined, maybe explained a little more. But the story was, you know, it didn't have glaring plot holes, but it had some little things in terms of the science behind the plot and the technology that they, you know, created for this film, and also some of the ghost stuff itself. There was a little bit of plot holes, but other than that, it's a fun movie that you can, you know, watch. And it's not the worst thing in the world. People were treating this like it was the absolute end of the world, because I think they were mainly blinded by the, you know, the marketing, and blinded by the fact that, oh, my precious, precious original film is being tainted by this awful monstrosity, when it's not the case. You know, it's a solid film. In terms of remakes, reboots that we've seen, especially in 2016, this is not the worst that we could have possibly gotten for a, you know, new series in the Ghostbusters franchise. It simply was not that bad. And people treated it like it was terrible, when it really is a solid, fun movie. Now, let me go into some more of the specifics. In terms of the characters, I felt that they brought their own strengths to this kind of original group that we had for the Ghostbusters. You know, you have Aaron Gilbert, who is, you know, they're all their own character, but with a little bit of the same sort of feeling and vibe that we got from the initial group. Aaron Gilbert, I guess, would, she would, I guess, be Bill Murray, but, like, I don't really see it that way. She is her own character. She's probably the one character that is the most different from the original film. Then we have the Abby Yates. She would definitely be a really good representation of a female version of Dan Aykroyd's classic character. And then, of course, Patty really is kind of like Ernie Hudson in, I guess, some similarities, some not. Patty has way more of a distinct kind of character, distinct passion and drive and motivation, and a clear different personality. But of course, it is the one, you know, outside person who isn't necessarily a scientist, who just happened to join the team. And so you do get the same sort of similarities in terms of storyline and fitting into the Ghostbusters atmosphere. It's just that it, you know, happened in a different way, which is good. I have always been a believer of remakes and reboots, not just copying from the original. Taking those risks to make a different, unique, but still connective film from the original. And then we also have the wonderful Kate McKinnon's character, who is so close to Egon. I truly don't think that this film would have been as strong with its cast if we didn't have Kate McKinnon playing this, you know, female version of Egon, if you will. Of course, they are two different characters, and, you know, I don't mean to hurt one or the other by saying that they're similar. I don't mean that for any of these characters. It's just a good kind of frame of reference in order to effectively talk about this movie. Let's get into more of the story, see what parts I had problems with, what I didn't have problems with. So the motivation for Rowan to want to bring these ghosts to destroy New York and then taking his life so that he could do it himself is super loose. I mean, you understand these stories of, oh, I was bullied and, you know, I might have a mental problem and, you know, I'm going to do these acts of violence. Of course, in this, it's played off in a very different way because it's ghosts and it's not real people, not necessarily real deaths. I guess I contribute, if I boil it down to its, you know, base property, it's kind of similar to how the Joker is played off. I mean, you look at that, it's someone who is troubled mentally, and then they just kind of crack and start doing things that are so outside the realm of normality to seemingly get back at those who have troubled them and plagued them throughout their life. But I think both sort of motivations, I will say Joker was way more grounded because of the way that whole film was treated. It was a lot more grounded. But with Ghostbusters, it's so loose. There's no explanation. You get one nod of, you know, being called a weirdo and a freak and kind of ridiculed a little bit by Annie Potts in the lobby. Still, it's not a strong enough case. One thing that really would have been cool is because he did predict a lot of what was going to happen throughout, if you saw the drawings in the book he owned of Ghosts of Our Past, or whatever the book in the movie is called. But you see those kind of predictions. It would have been a lot more interesting if instead of him just kind of knowing his plan and knowing it'll go perfectly fine, but instead, like, he has these psychic abilities, he sees into the beyond, because that's something that's tapped at but never really explained, how he's like, I've always been able to see things that other people can't or won't understand. And it would have been really interesting if his motivation was he got a message from the beyond, from one spirit who was particularly nasty, who fed him all this information to do these acts. I'm going to look at the first Ghostbusters. You have people and things that get possessed, led by a bigger spirit. Ghostbusters 2, you have the same sort of thing, except it's a little bit different. And they're a lot more juicy, because instead of it being a simple, oh, I was bullied and I want all to perish, which is a little exaggeration, but then again, this is a Ghostbusters movie. You have it where he's not the one calling the shots. You have someone else calling the shots. It would be a lot more powerful if that was what this villain's motives were. Also, you miss out on using traps. You just kind of knock ghosts out, which totally goes against the whole Ghostbusters brand. You know, you're not focusing on what makes that movie so cool and so unique, because there's these unique gadgets that were just kind of brought up out of thin air, and you bring in different gadgets, yes, but then they're short-lived. You barely see them. You see one trap for, I mean, less than 5 minutes of screen time. In the big fight scene with all the ghosts in Times Square, you see the glove, you see the gun, but you only see them for like 30 seconds or so at a time. It would have been a lot more interesting if you could keep the beginning of the movie very, very similar, but you jump into the creation of these gadgets a lot quicker so that they can be used throughout the film. Because, when you have these iconic storylines and these iconic ideas that you want to carry through into a remake or a reboot, you have to make sure you're preserving what is special about the original. I could clearly see through the writing that they wanted to do that. They wanted these nods to the classic gadgets and all these other ideas that were existing in the first two franchise in the first two films in the franchise, but you miss on the bigger picture of why they're important when you just kind of put nods towards them, or make new versions, but you don't feature them. I think one thing I will say, cameos are fun, but you can't flood a storyline with it. That's why this movie very unexpectedly had an extended release, because then you had these big names that you had to feature, but then it was a lot of screen time. The Dan Aykroyd one was great because it was short. The Ernie Hudson one made sense, but the Bill Murray one was a little longer than it needed to be. It could have simply been the mention on TV, and then they bring forth the government entity in a different way. Because if you have those gadgets already existing, what you could have done is at an event, you catch it, you trap it, physically actually trap it, and then the government comes to kind of confiscate your stuff, take your research. And then you have kind of some different drives for these characters, which makes them a little bit more refined, makes them a little bit more relatable, have the, make them have more motivation and a bigger character arc. But I understand how it sounds. This is not going to be a remake pitch. I am actually going to pitch a sequel. Because I think those are fun. I think that this is a movie that deserves to have a sequel. It deserves to have a continuation, because it's unfortunate that it was plagued from the start, when all in all, as if you look at it as its own thing, it's not that bad. It was marketed as something that was a reboot. The words that they were using to describe this film really hurt it. Because it's not really a reboot. It's not really a remake. It's a different thing. It's something completely different. And it just wasn't given a shot in marketing to be portrayed as such. I mean, I don't know. There's a lot to say. The score is fantastic. Some of the original music made for the film was a little odd because it was fit in at very obscure moments that maybe didn't need to have happened. It would have been really, really cool if there was a soundtrack inspired by this film and the original two films of the franchise that was released as maybe an anniversary type thing in conjunction with the home release of this film, and maybe just keep it to the original score that it had, because it really was strong, and it really did fit the vibe of this film. I just think that the original music shouldn't have been there. They could have really done a whole album of stuff inspired by the franchise and this film and release it on the anniversary date, even though it wasn't going to be a big one back then, because the 35th just passed along. Still, you release it with this film initially coming out, but it's not music for the movie, it's music based on the movie, where you give these kind of really cool, unique artists opportunities to basically create little stories and retellings of this film and then the first two in the franchise. It could have been really interesting. It would have been a very different kind of element to bring into it. It would have given Ghostbuster Corps a little bit more to do when this film was initially released, because pretty much this film was released and then they greenlit a few projects and then that was that, and now they're just busy in development hell with not Ghostbusters 2020, because that's still that might be in post production at this point, but it's in development hell with the animated shows that they're trying to do, the other movies and stuff that they're trying to bring up with the Ghostbusters brand. I think it's a strong enough brand to do it. There's been so many different tellings of this group through comics, through the TV shows. It very much, through books too. I mean, it really is strong enough to be a leading franchise. It's just a matter of execution. Which is, you know, you could say that about anything. But really, all in all, this movie is really good. It's not bad. It has, you know, you understand the plot. You kind of can connect with the motivations a little bit, even if some of them really aren't grounded as far in reality as they could have been. I mean, the characters are funny. The writing was classic. Paul Feig, Melissa McCarthy, Kate McKinnon, Kristen Wiig, SNL humor. And it's really interesting that a big thing this film got criticized for was its comedic writing. When you look at the initial film, it's SNL. It's SNL people. It's written by SNL people. It is starring SNL people. And you look at it and you're like, ugh, God, this writing's terrible. It's just kind of, it's modern SNL humor. Not everyone, you know, relates with it. But it's not saying it's anything other than what it is. It's not being marketed as this groundbreaking film, much like how the original wasn't marketed as a groundbreaking film. It's a popcorn flick. And people just didn't really get to treat it as such. I don't know. Personally, I think it's a strong film. I think it's really good. I wish we were getting a sequel. Truly. I think that with this cast of characters and a good sequel idea, not to say mine is good or not good, but it's, you know, different. It would have been really interesting to see this progress further for the gang. So thanks so much for listening to the review. First, I've got an ad read from Anchor by me, and then we'll get right on to the sequel pitch. All right, I just want to say thanks again to Anchor for helping me get this podcast to you guys. And now let's get on with a sequel pitch. This one might not be as long as the 1-4 Detective Pikachu was, but it still is a good sequel pitch. So let's take a look at what was given to us at the end of the film through the after credits scene and just the resolution of the main story. So we have all these gadgets that were used in the final fight, and then also some gadgets that were designed by Kate McKinnon's character at the very end that were just kind of there for show. And I think it would be a fantastic, fantastic way to open this film. Instead of the classic way where we see a haunting happening or something happen, we start it right in the middle of some action. You start it, we're using these new gadgets, traps, gear, and they're just fighting a big monster that, you know, happened to come along in the city. You know, they're all ready. They're there. They're fighting. They trap it. So then they get back in the car. They drive back to the headquarters. And they're talking about how, wow, I can't believe this came up. It's been, you know, really kind of dodgy here and there. And it's been the first thing we've had for, you know, a few months now. And then, you know, you get some good banter between all of the cast, McKinnon, McCarthy, Wig. Why can't I remember her name? I said her name. You know her name. Oh, man. Why can't I think of her name? Anyway, you get the four original ones. They're talking about it, bantering, you know. You get those jokes. And then we were also left with, at the end of the film, a nod to Zool, which is interesting to say Zool as opposed to Gozer. I understand that's how the first film's paranormal event was introduced, as, you know, Zool starting. But I think it should have been Gozer. You know, whatever. But this actually could be a really good opportunity to try something new. Instead of having Gozer be in it, it's just Zool. It's Zool because for some reason Zool has gotten through the barrier and needs to start building up power and recruiting for the coming of Gozer. We never get Gozer, but we get Zool. And we never get Vince Clortho. We could maybe get a little nod if Rick Moranis wanted to, you know, jump in. But you only have Zool. Zool is the main villain. You maybe rewrite Zool a little bit, change up the lore a little bit, bring in Tobin's spirit guide, or, you know, you can continue to use the internet like it was in the original, you know, in the first edition of Ghostbusters 2016. Ghostbusters Answer the Call. Have the internet be the resource. Maybe, you know, you can have some better, I say better, better gags with it. And, but, you know, the biggest thing to keep in mind is Zool is the main villain. So you see that, and then, you know, this, you know, ghost may be left behind some evidence to lead the Ghostbusters on this continuation, on this trail to Zool. We don't get any nods to the previous film. We get a sequel that is its own entity, that is not clinging on to the existing films in the franchise. We have it as a direct continuation from Ghostbusters Answers the Call, okay? And that's very important because I think a big reason, a big other reason why Ghostbusters Answer the Call didn't do great is because it was kind of weighted by the existing films in the franchise and relied too heavily on that when it needed to be its own thing. And that's where a lot of the struggle for Ghostbusters Answer the Call came from. Now, this ghost, you know, leaves behind some evidence, starts leaving, you know, it, one ghost leaves a trail, then another one comes up, maybe it's at the Mercado again, and we start getting these kind of hot spots all over the city, leading to the infamous apartment building on Central Park West. Now, I understand I said it cannot cling on to the past films in the franchise, but I think bringing back this iconic building actually makes sense for this film to be a successful sequel, because you're not relying onto the past films and the past entries in the franchise. You're basing it on the lore of the Ghostbusters universe. Now, in comics and in the books and in the TV show, this building has been brought up in different versions of Ghostbusters universes. So it's not uncommon to have this building pop up once again in a Ghostbusters franchise. It's lore. It's not just a nod to another film. It's lore. Now, I understand that the Mercado was trying to fill that gap, but, you know, it's not so bad to go back to the lore of the franchise. So, we have it leading to this building. We don't bring up the crazy plans and design of this building. We just have all these ghosts lead here. There's no human villain, but they go to this building. I'm going to say right around the halfway mark, maybe a little bit before. So they go to try and figure out what's going on. It leads them to the roof, which at this point you think, oh, okay, so they're about to do what they did in the first film. No. What they actually end up doing is they can hear Zool. It's not the same design at all from the first movie. It's a very different building, just same name, same location, same kind of history behind it, without directly introducing what the building is and what it stands for and how it's designed. So what they end up actually doing is releasing Zool. So instead of Zool trying to find a host or, you know, someone to help bring Gozer, we just let Zool loose purely by chance. And then this building just becomes, you know, a reference point for Zool to help unleash the paranormal activity in the city. So, with that, Zool, you know, after they let him out, they try and capture him. It fails. They're in tatters. They're, you know, not what they used to be, that kind of dialogue and theme we get. Zool leaps off the building and starts roaming around the city. And so then we get a really cool sort of chase scene of them trying to find Zool. And then it leads them to another location of interest, possibly. Or it could just lead them nowhere. Then, either way, they're not going to catch up with it and go fight it. They're going to lose the trail. So I guess it wouldn't necessarily be a place of interest. It'd just be that they follow it and, you know, whatever. Then after that, they get a call from the mayor, go down to the mayor's office. He asks, what's going on? What was that? You know, they're getting reports of this. You know, we get the two agents from the first film, you know, just to bring their hilarity into it. They, you know, say they couldn't catch him. Mayor gets mad because that's literally their one job. They then, you know, get out of there. Holtzman starts doing some research and finds Zool in the Tobin Spirit Guide. Now, it's just lore. You're not relying on the other films. Just because they set up this universe with its specific kind of locations and tools doesn't mean you can't use them. You just need to make sure you use them correctly. Maybe Tobin's Spirit Guide is like an online forum. You know, that brings it a lot closer with what we saw in the film with like Ghost News website, which I think was a huge missed opportunity, but you know, can't really blame Paul Feig for not knowing what internet forums are. So anyway, they go on the forum. They start looking up stuff about Zool, start looking up stuff about the building. Don't really find as much on the building. We don't get that kind of backstory that we got in Ghostbusters 1 because we've heard it before. We just know that it is the site of a lot of paranormal activity. And then Zool, you know, we find as a demon that has to help bring along the coming of Gozer. At that point, there's another big event that happens in the city, and this is about probably the start of Act 3. They go to find it. So then what we get is basically the Ghostbusters have to go to possibly all of the existing hotspots, or we have all of the landmarks that they had to visit to catch the first groupings of ghosts in the first and beginning half of the second act. We have to go back to those locations because there's powerful connections to the building and powerful connections to Zool. Once they do that, then we get this massive surge of energy back at the Dana Barrett's apartment on Central Park West. So they go there. At this point, we realize that there are some big things at stake. Gozer may seriously come. So we get Zool there. At this point, we can also get Vince Clortho. Not in the human versions, but we get a redesigned, sort of different look from what we got in the first film. And then at this point, we get this great battle, because then we can actually have it kind of interesting. They literally come together to be one giant paranormal being, paranormal entity, that they have to then fight off. And it could be this beautifully constructed, great fight scene. They catch these ghosts, or what they think, and everything seems to settle. You know, we get that kind of calming feel. It's not quite over yet. Then we actually do have Gozer arrive. So Gozer comes through the top of the building, you know, in whatever way, shape, or form. And, you know, they have to close these doors. We're not crossing streams. We're not throwing those grenades in. We're actually going to do what they tried to do in the first movie, outwit Gozer. So, you know, we actually do get this big sort of grand fight against Gozer. That's a real fight where Gozer is bringing up a bunch of, you know, paranormal things, throwing these Ghostbusters across the city, just terrorizing them while they're going through this battle for their lives and the lives of everyone in New York City. Somehow they gain the edge. Mentally, we could have some sort of weird hang-up that is introduced in the film somehow that actually gives them the edge. And it gives them the edge. They defeat Gozer. But, of course, the city is in ruins. We're not going to get that clean resolution we got in Ghostbusters 1 or Ghostbusters Answer the Call. It's a mess. Ghostbusters are, you know, dealing with it. And we get this kind of fun scene of them going around cleaning the city. It's, you know, it's a big kind of joke in terms of the story. And they, you know, have saved the city. All is resolved. And we could have it kind of be a weird thing with the mayor, or, you know, maybe we could even have it that the mayor brought along. Oh, that would be great. Yeah. So what ends up happening is somehow the mayor brought along Zool so that for his upcoming campaign, with him supporting the Ghostbusters, we have the motivation for why they're here. And it's so that he will get reelected because once again, he saved New York City. So then with that, the agents get dismissed. Cecily Strong gets fired. And they actually, you know what? We could have it where they actually hire Cecily Strong's character to work for them on a trial basis to then bring another hilariously funny individual into the Ghostbusters team. Now, it could literally just be someone to help Kevin, or it could be like a financial advisor or a business manager, something, because these Ghostbusters now don't have the funding from the mayor, so they need to support their own business. So then they hire this woman from the mayor's office to aid them with that, be their business manager, take care of finances, all of that. Which I think would actually be a really interesting way to kind of have another addition to this great franchise, close it out. But then we get the opportunity to bring in another creature for the third iteration of the Ghostbusters Answer the Call film trilogy. Yeah, we'll have it be trilogy. No, I'm just thinking forwardly, but I'm just saying by closing it off in kind of that sort of way, it allows for a lot more possibilities down the line. You know, there's a lot more chance to open it up, make it really different, have it be its own thing from the other Ghostbusters franchises because it's completely different. It's a completely different film, and it could just be done in a really tasteful way that people appreciate, and, you know, it'll be its own thing, and it could be respected enough as its own entity, especially considering we're getting a continuation of the Ghostbusters films with Ghostbusters 2020. So it makes sense to have this other franchise, especially considering how development is going out at Ghostbuster Corps, where they have so many announced projects and nothing's really moving ahead with them as far as the public knows. So it would just be a really interesting thing to bring these cast of female Ghostbusters back and have them kind of have this fun adventure that is connected to the existing lore of the Ghostbusters franchise, but is its own thing. It's its own fun event, and it's different ghosts, it's different things. We get a look at more of the specifics of ghosts. Because we really didn't see many ghosts in Ghostbusters Answer the Call. We saw a lot more kind of fun stuff in Ghostbusters 1 and 2 in terms of ghosts. Of course, they were all part of one bigger entity, whereas in Ghostbusters Answer the Call, there wasn't that, which kind of explains a little bit more for why people were not keen on it. But then it kind of brings it back into the franchise, but it's different enough, it's its own thing, and it's dynamic enough where people appreciate it and people actually enjoy it. So yeah, thank you so much for listening. This was just me talking for as long as I could think of Ghostbusters stuff. I mean, I'm gonna be completely honest with you guys. I just came up with that sequel idea off the top of my head. I had just finished this movie and I'm like, I have to talk about it. It's not a bad movie. It gets too much of a bad rap. There's too much going against it. And so I'm like, I'm going to do a podcast and I want there to be a sequel. So I'm just going to pop up with the sequel idea in my head. I hope this was interesting for you guys. Usually, when I do these sort of things, I have a little bit more preparation. Like, I take notes, I make sure I kind of know everything about the film. Usually I'll have something pulled up on my computer, but this time I just winged it and I thought it was really interesting. It was really fun for me. I hope it was fun for you guys. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks again to Anchor for sponsoring this podcast. And I hope I get to do more of these in the future. I'm going to try and stay a little bit more frequent with it, but since I'm going to be in school, it might be even harder to do. Sorry again about that blackout. And thank you so much for listening. And this has been Here's the Pitch with Mike Techno.